Question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just
a second.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a weekly digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. Sitting in for Sonali, I am Thainmori Soundararajan.
The bellows chilling at my spine.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
It's our second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. We will look at the reconstruction efforts, the status of prisons, and the hurricane's continued impact on women.
Sorry if my eyes drop when the bellow mellows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Hello and welcome to Uprising. On the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, organizers and residents of New Orleans are demanding rights for displaced residents. Critics of recovery efforts assail the federal policies of the past 2 years as a reason why many Katrina survivors have not been able to return to their homes and to their lives. In the Lower Ninth Ward District, hit hard by the hurricane, residents and activists are still struggling to rebuild, and victims are still seeking to come back. Only 7% of the neighborhood's former residents have made their way home. Hundreds of homes, more so than in any part of the city, were slated to be demolished in the neighborhood before New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin was forced to call for a moratorium. Joining us to discuss reconstruction efforts are Jeffrey Buchanan, communications officer for the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial and co-author of the report, Where Did the Katrina Money Go?, and Daryl Malik Wiley, environmental justice organizer with the Sierra Club.
Welcome.
So, Jeffrey, I actually wanted to start with you. Can you talk a little bit about how much money was allotted for rebuilding in the Gulf and how much money has been spent?
Well, the White House likes to say that they sent a check for $114 billion to the region to rebuild. Through our research, we found that this is patently false. There's only about $35 billion available for actual rebuilding programs in the Gulf Coast. About two-thirds of the money that the White House likes to cite was actually for the emergency response. So that's things like the Coast Guard, we're clearing out some of the debris, temporary emergency housing. That's made up the bounty of the federal response to date. Actual rebuilding, we found, like I said, $35 billion, but only 42% of that, less than 42% of that, has actually been spent. So there's still money to be spent, but even the money available is not enough to cover the devastation.
Hmm. And what are your initial estimates about how much money would be needed if we were talking about a full recovery?
Well, you really have to look, community by community. But just to kind of give perspective, in Louisiana alone, they calculated that they had taken on about $100 billion worth of damage from Katrina. Within that, about $25 billion was to public infrastructure. To date, there's only about $3.6 billion available from the federal government Gulf Coast-wide to rebuild public infrastructure. And that has to be spread across five different states that were hit by the 2005 hurricanes. So just in public infrastructure, we're seeing that there's going to need to be a significant federal investment to really bring things back up to where they were, which we should really be looking towards what's a 21st century infrastructure, not just rebuilding what was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have been kind of organizing around.
Well, and Daryl, I want to go to you. I feel like there's actually kind of two groups of NOLA residents, and their struggles are very different and obviously connected.
Right.
I think that there's NOLA folks who are on the ground in New Orleans struggling to kind of make do and get back their lives, and then there's folks trying to return to NOLA. And I wanted to get your sense, like, what really characterizes their struggles, and what do you see as some of the main barriers towards them coming back and being able to rebuild fully?
Well, I think, the main barriers is the money has never got to Louisiana. I'm working with residents in Lower Ninth Ward in the Holy Cross neighborhood, and it's real hard. Many folks got a free ride, a free bus ride, a forced bus ride, in some cases, to someplace else. And there's no free money to bring them back. There's no return ticket. And if they return, there's no housing right now, and that's one of the big problems, a lack of affordable housing. And what we're seeing in the Holy Cross neighborhood is people coming back, but it's on an individual case-by-case basis that have the resources to come back or know somebody or, you know, it's a very much an individual struggle. The federal dollars are just almost non-existent.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind our listeners on the phone, that was Daryl Malik Riley, environmental justice organizer for the Sierra Club. Also joining us is Jeffrey Buchanan, co-author of the report, Where Did the Katrina Money Go? So, Jeffrey, I wanted to go back to you. What's your biggest sense of where the battle for accountability is regarding this money and also to support NOLA residents to really get back and be able to create their lives in a real way?
I think Daryl was really hitting it on the head, that the federal policy has not supported the human right to return home. If you look at international human rights law, after a disaster, especially a disaster caused by a federal government that displaces a large amount of people, those displaced people have a human right to be able to return and to participate in the rebuilding process. And we really have not seen that. We've seen very much a hands-off attitude from the federal government of saying that they're going to write the check and send it down to the region, while these struggling local governments and state governments that are, you know, rebuilding neighborhoods and communities from the ground up have not been able to, you know, get the job done as quickly as a strong, robust federal effort would have happened. We're looking, you know, really hoping that we can see a renewed federal effort, you know, if not in this presidency, definitely in the, you know, we're asking among the 2008 candidates to really look at how little has been invested and how to make sure that we, you know, give a proper investment and get it there quickly and get it done efficiently. Really trying to rebuild the housing, the schools, the healthcare system, you know, the flood protection, the things that are really necessary for people to come home.
Well, and I think that one of the things that I found really interesting is that there was a lot of emphasis in terms of individuals looting right after Katrina, but there wasn't really a lot of stories that looked at the institutional looting that really came from the enormous amount of corruption that happened at state and local and federal levels around money that could have protected the region, but then was, you know, taken off in terms of corruption or money towards the war. And I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you in terms of trying to keep our eye on the money is really about in terms of, like, knowing that there was corruption in these agencies beforehand, how can there even really be trust afterwards to know that they're going to be able to use this rebuilding money well? Because from what I've seen in terms of the numbers, even, like, what's been rebuilt, there isn't, like, a conversation about what gets the priority in terms of money.
No, I guess, you know, there is, you know, on a lot of people, there is a lot of feeling that there has been money that's been misused. But, I mean, it is possible for the federal government to carry out a new investment. You look back to the New Deal, you look back to a program like the WPA, and just how little fraud there was in that kind of program where the federal government was carrying out this large-scale kind of federal works program. It is possible. We can't expect it of our government. You know, it's just going to require Congress or the next president to really put into place what a robust effort's going to look like and how to make sure that it's held accountable and we don't have folks like the Shaw Group, like Halliburton, like all these federal contractors that got their hands on this initial money in these contracts, you know, abusing the people's money and not focusing on helping families return home and restore their communities.
Do you have a number, Jeffrey, on, like, how much money went into those private contracts?
Well, Congress actually did some investigation, and they found about $9 billion in contracts that had either had fraud, misuse. This was through Representative Henry Waxman's Committee on Oversight. Mm-hmm. They found, you know, almost $9 billion. So that's almost a tenth of the money, you know, that had gone into the system, that there had been fraud or some kind of, you know, misconduct, which, you know, really is in the aftermath of the storm, when the first big emergency response contracts were given out. It was kind of a Wild West bonanza of misspending and misuse, and not a real focus on, you know, these displaced families and these communities that really needed to, you know, have this money used in a proper way.
Yeah. Well, and I'd like to go to you, Daryl. When we talk now of NOLA individuals, like, where are they in terms of their finances? Where's, like, the federal money gone in terms of supporting them? And are they still receiving FEMA checks? Are those checks, like, coming on time?
It's real spotty, and it's very much, you know, each individual case is different. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is not a real strong support anyway. And, you know, the part of the problem has been that we've focused on they've gotten checks for FEMA trailers, but the FEMA trailers have high levels of formaldehyde in them. And I don't know, you know, it's not the kind of place where we want people to be living. So it's just the whole federal response has been failed in our view. And I think one thing that we need to talk about in New Orleans, especially the whole across, they've got a vision of how they want to come back. And they want to come back sustainable, green energy, solar panels, all these really far-thinking ideas. And this is being driven by the folks in the neighborhood. And I think that's part of the story that's not getting out.
Well, can you talk to us about what that vision for green rebuilding is, particularly in the context that, you know, we can't reverse, global climate change. And
right.
So, you know, New Orleans will be on the front lines for future hurricanes. So what does that model for green look like for you all?
Right. It looks a number of different things. One, we build in ways that are sustainable and, you know, we raise our house elevations. We reduce our carbon input. Solar panels, energy efficiency, a whole range of things. And then we have a very active program to restore the coastal wetlands. You know, one of the things that we're concerned about, the Corps keeps talking levees, levees, levees. We don't hear them talking coastal marsh restoration, cypress swamp, you know, rebuilding. So it's easier to write a check to put in concrete than it is to rebuild trees or replant trees.
And why would the restoration of the swamplands around that area bring protection to New Orleans? Because many of our listeners aren't familiar with the area.
The whole South Louisiana has lost tremendous wetlands, but every mile of wetlands reduces storm surge 2 to 3 feet. And if it's cypress trees and cypress swamp, it helps reduce not only the storm surge but the wind because of just friction of the wind going through the trees. So it's really a natural barrier system that we need to reinstall, and it's mainly been taken apart because of oil and gas exploration over the many years.
Hmm. And can I ask also, Daryl, and knowing that there's been this kind of, you know, huge glut of money that's been supposedly allotted for recovery and very few dollars have actually drizzled down back to people in NOLA, what has been people's response and how they've been organizing around this?
A lot of angry people and, you know, trying to organize in political ways because we have to understand we might be able to get, and we usually do get, the Louisiana congressional delegation to support more money down here. But it's going to take congressmen from California, from Alaska, from Hawaii, from all across the country to make the political decision to spend the money in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast rather than someplace else.
Jeffrey, I want to go back to you. Now, you're also with the Institute for Southern Studies, and what was your hope in terms of the report, and how are you hoping that this report can influence some of the policy change that Daryl is talking about?
Well, definitely. I think the one thing that the Louisiana delegation has really come into, or when, you know, local officials within the state of Louisiana come up, or even Mayor Nagin, again and again in these hearings, we'll see that congressmen say, we sent you all this money, why hasn't there been more progress? And with the federal policy of, you know, saying that they've sent money and putting the onus on the local government, they've been able to use these manipulated numbers that don't really mean anything about rebuilding to kind of really stall out the process and to stall the process of actually thinking about a renewed investment. And we really wanted to just really set the tone and set the truth out there that there's only $35 billion available, and we're looking at a storm that did Gulf Coast-wide about $150 billion worth of damage. That was a study that came out of Marshall University. Potentially, this storm could be bigger than the three largest disasters our nation has ever seen combined, so bigger in financial cost than the September 11th attacks, than the Hurricane Andrew or the Northridge earthquake combined, all three of those in one. That was this one disaster. And there really has not been that outpouring of real rebuilding programs from the federal government. We wanted to restart that conversation and hopefully, you know, let people know what the truth is, how much money there is to rebuild. We're in the rebuilding phase. The emergency response is over with. let's talk about rebuilding this region.
Before we leave, I want to be able to leave our listeners with websites where people can both look at the report and also follow the organizing, Daryl, that you're doing on the ground. So, Jeffrey, can you leave us with the website where they can read your report?
You can see the report at www.southernstudies.org/GulfWatch.
Okay. That's southernstudies.org / what's the last bit?
Gulf Watch.
Okay. That was Jeffrey Buchanan, co-author of the report, Where Did the Katrina Money Go? A report by the Institute for Southern Studies. And Daryl, can you leave us information for where people can follow the ongoing environmental justice efforts in
the region? The main website that has a lot of information about Holy Cross is www.helpholycross.org, and that's sort of gives people an idea of all the great work that's been going on in that neighborhood.
Okay, that's www.helpholycross.org. Thank you both for joining us. We have been speaking with Jeffrey Buchanan, Communications Officer for the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial and co-author of the report, Where Did the Katrina Money Go?, and Daryl Malik Wiley, Environmental Justice Organizer with the Sierra Club. For more information, visit www.southernstudies.org and www.helpholycross.org. Later in the hour, we'll discuss the hurricane's continued impact on women and the status of Orleans Parish prisons. But first, the Black Agenda Report. You're listening to Uprising on the web at uprisingradio.org. We'll be right back. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about Alberto Gonzalez.
Alberto Gonzalez resigned as Attorney General of the United States this week, a body blow to Latino pride. But the Hispanic press, which is much more vibrant and active than the black press, took the occasion in stride and with great dignity. As reported by the excellent website Richard Prince's Journalisms, the Latino press resisted the reflexive urge to circle the wagons around one of their own, and accepted the fact that Alberto Gonzalez is George Bush's boy, who worked against their interests and should not be defended. Contrast that with the usual reaction from what's left of black media when an African-American politician of dubious repute and no loyalty to his own people gets attacked by racists. Case in point, former Memphis Congressman Harold Ford Jr., in the last days of his losing campaign for the U.S. Senate, the Republican opposition bought ads on statewide television showing white girls acting like girls gone wild over Harold Ford. It was a racist attack, certainly. Predictably, black folks circled the wagons around the undeserving Harold Ford Jr., and in doing so, we debased ourselves, defending a man who never defended us. Harold Ford was the worst black congressman to ever hold office. He professed openly that he loved George Bush. Ford ran around the country during Bush's campaign to kill Social Security, hugging and kissing Republicans and pledging to bring down the only social safety net that still exists in the United States. Harold Ford was one of only four black congresspersons to vote in favor of Bush's war powers in 2002. He initiated the rightward tilt that has crippled the Congressional Black Caucus, which can no longer claim to be the conscience of the Congress. Harold Ford Jr. now is in a holding pattern as head of the Democratic Leadership Council, the right-wing bagman for corporate money in the Democratic Party, an organization that was created for the specific purpose of diminishing black and union power in the Democratic Party. In other words, Harold Ford is the enemy. Alberto Gonzalez is the enemy as well. He was the key player in the theft of the 2004 election, which required the disenfranchisement of Hispanic and black voters in many states. He betrayed his own people, Latinos, and the American people. He is a criminal, not a source of pride, but a fountain of shame. The Latino media were mature enough to understand their communal interests, that traitors with a Spanish surname are even more dangerous than Anglos on a racist mission. It appears that black media are anchored back in the Jim Crow days, when we marshaled all of our energies to defend every rascal politician that came up from our ranks. After so many generations, this has become a reflex reaction, but is not politically healthy. Barack Obama calls for 100,000 more U.S. soldiers and Marines, a black man boosting the imperial project. Are we supposed to support him? So what if White Girls Gone Wild ads appear, featuring pale and lascivious women wanting to get into Obama's pants? Do we allow racist attacks to dictate our politics? Have we gone stupid? For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. Welcome back to Uprising. A 43-year-old inmate became the fourth person to die in Louisiana Orleans Parish Prison in 2007. Prison officials claim the man died of an apparent suicide committed in a 10-person cell, though an autopsy has yet to be performed. Orleans Parish Prison, which was the eighth largest city jail in the nation pre-Katrina, has yet to regain accreditation lost in the wake of the storm. 2 years ago, hundreds of inmates were abandoned in the facility as the floodwaters rose. Now, inmates continue to complain of poor conditions, such as overcrowded 10-person cells, amongst other problems. High incarceration rates continue to affect the impoverished due to state laws that allow for people to be locked up if they are unable to post bail. Residents of New Orleans have organized against the crisis of the city's criminal injustice system. Safe Streets, Strong Communities is an example of community members and activists coming together to address injustices in the system. The organization has pushed for independent police oversight and has sought the downsizing of Orleans Parish Prison. Rosetta James, a member of Safe Streets Strong Communities, lost her 29-year-old son in Orleans Parish Prison after he died prior to his day in court. Prison officials told James that her young son's death was due to natural causes. Joining us to talk about the criminal injustice system in New Orleans in the 2 years since the Katrina disaster is Rosanna Cruz, co-director of Safe Streets Strong Communities, and Robin Templeton, author of the article Locked Up in New Orleans, which is published in the most recent edition of The Nation. Rosanna, can I talk with you first? What are we dealing with when we look at what's wrong with the prison system in New Orleans? I mean, there's the facts and then there's the stories, and you guys are really on the ground. So can you share some of that with us?
Absolutely. When we talk about what's going wrong with the prison system, we have to recognize, in terms of what prisons are designed for and their history, which I think Robin did an excellent job in outlining specifically the history of Orleans Parish Prison, as far as they're concerned, nothing's going wrong. The prison's doing exactly what it's supposed to do, which is, you know, in our opinion, it's just kind of a tool in building patronage power for different political machines and for different political actors in the city. There is an extensive prison labor project that the sheriff basically uses to dole out cheap labor to different agencies and businesses in the city. And so what we're seeing is, and certainly the principle is, you know, if you build it, you will fill it. And so as you know, prisons across the nation, the prison industry is a growth industry, and so we know that in terms of what the prison industrial complex is designed for, it's certainly accomplishing its own goals in terms of keeping people in a system where the folks come in, and particularly in New Orleans, the specifics are really telling, right? Because people get arrested. Let's say that I get arrested today. on even a minor municipal charge, a misdemeanor. I get arrested. I go to OPP. It's supposed to be a city jail, but it's, you know, before the storm, it was the largest city jail in the country. And, you know, the scale of it is just really disproportionate in terms of what a city jail is supposed to accomplish. So I get locked up today. The police report may not go to the DA's office for weeks. And then the DA has 45 days for a misdemeanor, 60 days, and even longer if it's a capital offense, right? So then that gets transferred. But those are the days that I spend sitting in jail waiting for the DA's office to decide to take the charges or not. And so in that time, I lose my job, I lose my housing in certain instances, and in many cases, come the 45th day, because the system has been so dismantled or disorganized since the storm, I can sit longer if the proper avenues aren't functioning for that paperwork to go through and for me to get what's called 701 out. And so we have people basically serving time before they're even tried, right? So you get an arraignment, but beyond that, you just sit. And so in that process, people lose any kind of economic stability that they had. And we know through policing that, and through our membership, that it's the poorer communities that are targeted. So we're talking about already vulnerable populations.
That was Rosanna Cruz, co-director of Safe Streets, Strong Communities. I want to turn now to Robin Templeton, author of the article Locked Up in New Orleans, which has just been published in the most recent edition of The Nation. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you.
Robin, I think in looking at your article, you did an excellent job of breaking down the history of Orleans Parish Prison. And I was wondering if you could bring some of that history and connect it to the way that the crisis in crime is really also part and parcel of a wider social crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rosanna's analysis is very important in terms of, you know, your listeners are in L.A., I'm here in New York. Prisons have a certain job to play in our society, given racism and the class stratification that we have. And because the economy was so torn apart and decimated in New Orleans, and because prisons are a growth industry everywhere, you have a situation where the jail and the law enforcement system got back together and has been refunded at a scale that makes every other social service look even more paltry than it already is. So you have the police force and the jail funded back to pre-Katrina capacity when you have one-third of the child care centers. So in terms of what crime problem there is, you have young people coming back to a city often without their families because they have no housing, without schools and job opportunities. And then any crime problem that exists, which is real in New Orleans, is used as a further justification for this massive acceleration of funding for the jail. In terms of its history, the jail, the Orleans Parish Prison, is actually, you know, the county jail. In terms of its size, you all talked about that. I mean, it would be the equivalent of having about 250,000 people locked up in Midtown Manhattan. That's the scale that we're talking about. The numbers would be even bigger in L.A., and it's right in the middle of the city. Back in the day when New Orleans was a colony, it was ruled by the French, the jail was called the workhouse. And if you look at archives that were written in French, and then they're translated, you see that folks who were of African descent who claimed to be free, in other words, it was right before the Civil War, right? And folks who were of African descent, if they were not still living on a plantation, New Orleans was an urban area, they would be arrested, put in the workhouse, and their description translated from the French was so called free. So folks who were in the jail would then be doled out to perform labor. And so in the wake of the Civil War, when you have a decimated city, slavery is illegal, black code laws were enforced, and so being on the street, being without a job, the equivalent of the nonviolent offenses that folks are being arrested for in New Orleans today. Folks were locked up, brought to the jail, and then used as a workforce. And those folks of African descent that were then free literally rebuilt the city during its first reconstruction. So the labor force that Rosanna was referring to in the jail now is technically voluntary, But if you then look at the conditions inside the jail, getting out to get fresh air, it is a luxury. So who wouldn't want to volunteer?
And, you know, I think one of the sad facts of the prison industrial complex is that with the 14th Amendment removing slavery, the only way that slavery is still allowed is in the prison system. And that's one of the most incredible things that we see, like, as the prison systems expand, you know. But Rosanna, I wanted to actually go back to you, because Safe Streets has really been one of the first responders to help people who are caught up within the prison system. And in reading the article, I was just shocked about, you know, there's so many stories that are shocking, and you think that there's a point where you can't be shocked anymore, but you know, they're just, it's just incredible. And what stood out for me was the woman who had actually called about a 9/11 domestic violence incident, and instead of the police coming to help her, ended up arresting her on an outstanding traffic violation. So when you're dealing with these cases and with people who are struggling, what are things that you're able to do to help fill the gap?
Absolutely. Well, I think that the important thing is that we're talking about stories that are devastating, right? And this week we've been in the process of, you know, commemorating the flood and testifying in this International Human Rights Tribunal about the stories that happen. And one of the important points is that our members, as they go up to testify as witnesses, you know, in this kind of process to bring the U.S. government to the International Criminal Court, they claim and they recognize that this is one of many stories behind it, right? So it's just recognizing the collective nature of this experience, and that there's a pattern of disproportionate death and injury to low-income communities of color, especially Black communities, but we're seeing now with the rise of the Latino population here also an increase in the criminalization of Latinos and particularly immigrant workers. And so what Safe Streets has been doing, and I mean that's the other half of our name, right, is strong communities. The antidote to this devastation, the antidote to these horrible stories that we hear and the pain, I mean, you know, Rosetta James is one of our members. We had four members yesterday who personally testified about their experiences of loss and death at the hands of the state. All of these folks have come together, and through building relationships together and through organizing and reaching out to other community members, educating community members about their rights, doing advocacy on the ground. I mean, you know, in some cases, you know, I got a call last night. Somebody's loved one had been arrested. It had happened a couple of hours ago, and they still couldn't figure out where he had been taken. You know, so just being able to share information with folks who are looking for their loved ones, and this is something that we train our members to do in our advocacy training. They can go into the system. They can help find folks. They can advocate for folks to make sure that they get their court dates, which is a really big problem here.
My guests have been Rosanna Cruz, co-director of Safe Streets, Strong Communities, and Robin Templeton, author of the article Locked Up in New Orleans, which is published in the most recent edition of The Nation. For our last story of the day, we'll take a look at ongoing impacts of Katrina on women in the Gulf. Up next, Empire Notes. You're listening to Uprising on the web at uprisingradio.org. We'll be right back. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filled by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and the New Crusade. This week's commentary is on Bush and Vietnam.
It's not very interesting to take apart the latest bizarre rhetorical gambit from the White House, analogizing Iraq to Vietnam in order, strangely, to argue against withdrawal on the grounds that allegedly premature withdrawal in 1975 led to bloodbaths in Vietnam and Cambodia, and that the same thing could happen in Iraq. There was, of course, no bloodbath in Vietnam after the North Vietnamese victory. Or if you want to term the reprisals after an utterly wrenching 25-year conflict so, then they constituted a bloodbath on the order of the carnage wrought by the United States in perhaps a month of the war. They were also a similar order to the executions of an estimated 10,000 collaborators and suspected collaborators in France after its liberation in World War II. And the Nazi occupation of France was nothing compared to the U.S. occupation of Vietnam, even if you include the killing of close to 100,000 French Jews. The bloodbath in Cambodia, of course, had nothing to do with U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, and a great deal to do with the savage bombing in the first half of the 1970s that probably killed several hundred thousand Cambodians and drove many others into the arms of the Khmer Rouge. And indeed, it was not the wonderful West, but rather the Vietnamese haters of freedom who liberated the Cambodians from the Khmer Rouge's auto-genocide. In fact, afterward, because of our vicious refusal to forgive Vietnam for the wrongs we had done it, we supported the Khmer Rouge. That last, somehow, in all the moral posturing of cruise missile liberals, we never quite hear. It's as if we constantly justified our own aggression by invoking the evil of the Nazis and the specter of Munich, even though we worked with Nazis and even helped them into positions of power after the genocide they committed. Oh, wait, we did that too. What's particularly strange about the argument is that the case for a bloodbath in Iraq after the U.S. leaves is far stronger than the non-existent case for a bloodbath that didn't happen in Vietnam. After all, there's already a bloodbath in Iraq. Anyway, refutations of Bush's absurd argument have been pouring in from journalists, historians, and virtually anyone with functioning brain cells and a laptop. Although for the most part they're ably done, soberly and sensibly reasoned, reading them, my first reaction is to say that I agree with Bush. Iraq is almost exactly the same as Vietnam in one crucial way that all the commentariat have missed, and that Bush epitomizes in his own person. With Vietnam, we struggled hard and mostly successfully as a nation to make sure we didn't learn the true lessons of the war. And with Iraq, we are on track to the same achievement, although this time it seems the path will be much easier. This is a similarity that George Bush, a man who seemingly has never learned anything from anything or anyone in his entire life, is well positioned to appreciate. It is true that the mainstream of the intelligentsia did learn some things from Vietnam and some even from Iraq. For example, I've recently found out that we know now that Vietnam was not in fact a central front in the Cold War, much as we apparently learned that Iraq is not the central front in the War on Terror. What this means, I cannot imagine. Maybe the Cold War and the War on Terror are actually ethereal entities, abstract platonic forms that are not to be sullied by contact with reality. Perhaps we could have learned instead that the Cold War and the War on Terror were not just mis-executed, but misconceived. We've apparently learned from both of these wars that America's legendary good intentions are apparently not enough to ensure a good outcome. Perhaps we could have learned instead that it's very easy to assume you have good intentions, but that on close examination, it often turns out that you really don't. Although respectable opinion will have nothing to do with Bush's analogy, the fact that he could even dream of making it, what to speak of the fact that almost all of the refutations were based on pragmatic rather than moral arguments, speaks to a continuing moral idiocy with regard to Vietnam and a lot of other things, that spreads far beyond the revolting right wing. And Bush, the moral idiot, was not wrong about that. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Empire Notes is online at www.empirenotes.org. Welcome back to Uprising. When Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast, the devastation left in its wake ignited discussions on race and even class in the United States. However, even as women were disproportionately affected by the storm, few experts connected gender to the debate. Many major Katrina-related issues, such as housing, redevelopment, and environmental degradation, have taken their particular toll on low-income women and women of color. When speaking of the right to return and calling on the federal government to restore public housing, it is important to note that women-headed households accounted for 88% of public housing units lost in New Orleans before the storm hit. The majority of jobs lost due to Hurricane Katrina were overwhelmingly held by women, and after the storm, women's median income in New Orleans was significantly lower than that of their male counterparts. In Gulf Coast Reconstruction Watch's new report, 1 year after Katrina, Shayna Griffin, a NOLA women's organizer and national board member of Insight, states that it is important to not only offer services to the invisible women in the Gulf, but also challenge the conditions that limit our access and our opportunities, such as poverty, racism, gender-based violence, imperialism, and war. Despite the hardships faced, women activists in the Gulf Coast region have been engaged over the past 2 years in the task of reviving their respective communities. Multi-pronged strategic grants from the Ms. Foundation for Women have been helpful in supporting numerous community-based Gulf Coast organizations, predominantly led by low-income women and women of color. Through supported efforts, women in the hurricane-affected regions have been able to recover owned homes as well as win women important seats on planning commissions. My guests are Amitra Franklin, CEO of St. Mary's Community Action Agency and the Louisiana Housing Alliance, and Sarah Gold, president of the Ms. Foundation for Women.
Thank you very much.
Well, Amitra, can you share with our listeners where you are from in New Orleans and what the women you live with are grappling with in your community?
Actually, I'm from a rural community outside of New Orleans, about 90 miles. It's St. Mary Parish, and it's actually the towns of Franklin, the municipalities of Franklin, Morgan City, Patterson are within that jurisdiction. A lot of the women that came from New Orleans are now in St. Mary Parish. They have chose to stay here. A lot of them want to go back home, but there are no provisions for getting them and the children back into their home areas.
Mm. And when you're talking about, I think one of the things in looking at what Shayna was talking about is that you can't really look at the way services are being offered to support women without first addressing the fact that the women were invisible. How did you feel that women in the Gulf were made invisible throughout the whole Katrina process, like both like immediately after the hurricane was hit and in the corresponding months?
Well, one of the things that I found most disturbing about the plight of women and children was that there were no specific projects available to them other than for nonprofits. As they started to work through FEMA and Road Home and Louisiana Housing Authority and all of the different projects that were set up, they were mostly directed toward two-family households. Mm. And the plight of single parents, mostly headed by single African-American women, were never a target group.
That's right. I also thought what was, mostly immediately after Katrina, in when people were trying to find refuge, I think that there was a lot of incidences about violence that happened towards women, whether it was by the National Guard or the police or even within the evacuees within the Superdome. How do you feel like some of that violence was tracked, and has there been any accountability afterwards? And what are the women asking for in terms of accountability and support for healing afterwards?
I tell you, you know, we heard a lot of that, and a lot of the ladies that we did the case management with, they discussed it. Some of them were traumatized by that. But because they had a more immediate need, that was survival, having housing for their children, making sure the children got in adequate schooling and that they got jobs or had some source of income coming in, that was not our first priority with the women. Our first priority was making sure that they had shelter, that they had a place to stay, and that the children were able to get in school. However, the second part of that was that we tried to provide some counseling for some of the ladies or develop support groups. where they could talk about some of the experiences that they had. Like one lady told me she had not been able to sleep at night because she remembered seeing a baby drown during the time she was trying to get out of the hurricane path.
I want to remind our listeners that is Amita Franken, CEO of St. Mary's Community Action Agency and the Louisiana Housing Alliance. I want to turn to you, Sarah. You are president of the Miss Foundation, and I want to talk about how did the Miss Foundation get involved in supporting the women in the Gulf, and what were some of the challenges you faced in being able to give the people that needed the resources right at the point of need?
Well, the Miss Foundation responded immediately the weekend that the levees broke and New Orleans and the Gulf Coast was in such, unconscionable situation, because it's very related to our mission. It's core to our mission to be working with and responding to those most in need, and particularly women of color and low-income women. And we work at the intersection of race, class, and gender. So we began to raise money immediately, and we reached out to our grantees in the region, those we already had, and got some emergency funding down to them, including organizations working on with women on HIV and AIDS, working on sexual assault, domestic violence, the shelters, of course, in New Orleans and in other places across the coast were as devastated as and were out of business. So there was much that needed to be responded to immediately. We felt that our longer-term niche was in recovery and rebuilding, and we had a vision that when an area and a region has been so decimated, that perhaps it opens up space for there to be new kinds of conversations and new voices that have not been at tables before able to come forward. And that has been pushing our work for the last 2 years. We've now granted about $2 million on the Gulf Coast to a variety of organizations that are working on issues from daycare to housing to representation and civic participation in general. And I wanted to make one comment on the invisibility of women. Of course, it goes back to before the hurricanes. Women are invisible, and African-American women, low-income women, other women of color, even more invisible than white women in our society because of this intersection of sexism and racism and all of the other barriers that are put in the way in our democracy towards real equal participation, towards working towards a more equal representation and participation for everyone.
And I want to just repeat the fact that I think that it's really invisible to the media and invisible in terms of the policymakers, but not invisible in terms of the New Orleans and really in our larger society. And I wanted to self-correct on that, because in just going back to the statistics, it was amazing that in so much of the coverage that happened in terms of the housing that was lost, that there was very few mainstream media outlets that noted that 80% of the public housing units that were lost were like led by women. To me, I think that's just as unconscionable. And I want to go back to you, Almitra. How have you seen women being able to come to the table differently in the reconstruction process? And has stuff changed? And what do you think are some of the challenges that women are facing?
Well, one of the things I saw that I'd not seen before, women were more vocal before, even with the Head Start program and with our housing movement, and not only in the in my work area, which is again mostly rural, but throughout the state, women would not come to the table per se to discuss those issues about housing and the need for housing and how we needed to ramp up and really have a section of houses that was dedicated to ladies, to single households, to mothers with children. But women have really been coming to the table. I think Katrina really forced the issue with women, and it made them understand that I am going to have to speak up for myself and for my children.
We've been speaking with Almitra Franklin, CEO of St. Mary's Community Action Agency and the Louisiana Housing Alliance. And also on the line is Sarah K. Gould, president of the Miss Foundation for Women. Almitra, what do you think, if for people that want to support women in the Gulf, and who for people that don't really know what it's like in the Gulf, what do you think, how can people best support the work that you're doing? And what are, once again, I think just if you can give us some stories about like what women are dealing with and their challenges, I think that'll help really paint the picture for our audience.
A lot of the ladies that we work with who came out of New Orleans and the surrounding area are still having a really rough time locating permanent housing. We still have a lot of these families who are in the FEMA trailers. There are currently some issues with the trailers about a formaldehyde and the safeness of those trailers. We're trying to move those families back to New Orleans who wish to go there, but there's no housing there, let me say that.
I mean, it's incredible that 2 years, you still have people
exactly
living
right.
in temporary housing.
Exactly right. And the ladies who have chose to relocate to rural communities or communities like mine, you know, there's no housing available because we had an influx of additional residents in our area that caused the already strained housing market to just burst open. Mm-hmm. Therefore, what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop housing that can assist these families. Public housing authorities have units that have been boarded up, have been closed up. What they have done and put on their agenda is to rehabilitate those units and open them up so that these families would have the opportunities to have at least some sort of normalcy in terms of housing. Living in a FEMA trailer is not a normal scenario family.
That's right. And you had mentioned about the shift of people being displaced into the rural parishes outside of the city. What has that been like culturally? Like, is that a cultural shift? Is it an economic shift?
I always tell my clients, it's like for those who are not used to being in this rural setting, it's like a culture shock. Because in the inner cities, they were able to catch the bus system and they were able to walk to many of the services that they needed. But because we're in a rural area, everything is so spread out, and the amount of transportation that's available is very limited. Therefore, you know, we had to address that issue. How are we going to get our clients from point A to point B? And we even had to do some innovative stuff. Like, for an example, we have a program called Cause for Our Cause, where those working mothers who decide they want to go through a literacy, financial literacy project, at the end of 6 months, they can get a car. It's a used car, but it's a relatively good car. It's a donated car to help them to get around and be able to go to things with the children, extracurricular things with the children, to even seek out spirituality. If they want to go to church on Sunday, they will have a form of transportation. Because, again, in the rural community, what you see in the city is so different.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, I wanted to go with you because I wanted to really see how are you trying to link the different strategies you're funding in the Gulf in terms of going from policy strange and structural change to the kind of internal transformative work, and how have you been successful, or what are some of the challenges around that?
There are many challenges around it because, of course, women like Almitra are working day in and day out on the most pressing needs, and also at the same time trying to think of how to solve problems for the future. We have combined in our work both the grant making to get money out to leaders and to organizations with some gathering and bringing people together for certain kinds of activities. For instance, 2 or 3 weeks ago, we brought together some of our grantees to learn about making radio documentaries, so that they could get these stories out that that you speak of that are so powerful, and all the stories that if we had the time, even more time to listen to Almitra, she could tell about herself and the women that she's been working with. So we've combined our grant making with other kinds of activities, and I'm in New Orleans right now, and 2 nights ago went to a gathering organized by one of our grantees, the National Coalition for Black Civic Participation, led by Melanie Campbell. And we have supported them to be gathering women throughout the region in the 3 states of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. About 60 or 75 of those women were brought to New Orleans for these couple of days of commemoration. And 2 nights ago, they had a celebratory dinner honoring all of these women for the role that each one of them has played, which was articulated during the dinner. And, you know, it's overwhelming. But it is a process of healing, of emotional healing and of spiritual healing, and moving forward on a day-by-day basis to try to confront all of the issues and problems that exist, to deal with the anger that you have, and to keep a sense of hope at the same time.
Well, Amita, we're going to have to wrap up this segment, but before we do, I wanted to be able to leave our listeners with a forward look at some of the policies that you are working on to support women's rights in the region. Is there one or two you could reference for our listeners before we close?
Sure. What the big thing with us right now, you know, is housing. We're concerned about women having adequate housing, and affordability means everything to the people we serve. We're working with the Louisiana Housing Alliance and the Louisiana Housing Authority, which is through the LHFA, to develop a housing trust fund for Louisiana. And a part of that trust fund would be directed to our targeting women who are heads of households, who have children in the house, who want to become homeowners.
All right. And can people visit you on the web? Is there a website where people can visit the work that you're doing?
My website is under construction right now. It was so old and outdated till we had to take it down to put some of the good things that we had available. So it's under construction right now, but I expect that in the next about 3 weeks it's going to be up. But just let me get that website out there. It's stmaryscaa.org.
St. Mary's.
And let me put out the Ms. website, where you can hear these radio documentaries and read more stories of the grantee leaders like Almitra that we're funding. And that is ms.foundationspelledout.org.
And it's a wonderful reference for us and for our clients, because when they can't get to our website, we tell them go to Ms. Foundation and you can see some of the work that we're doing there.
Okay. Well, thank you both for joining us. We send you all of our wishes for continued healing and also government accountability. So if there's any question that women's rights aren't human rights, this is really where the rubber meets the road. So thank you both for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. My guests have been Almitra Franklin, CEO of St. Mary's Community Action Agency and the Louisiana Housing Alliance, and Sarah Gould, president of the Ms. Foundation for Women. For more information, visit www.missfoundation.org and www.stmaryscaa.org. For Uprising Subversive Thought, I'd like to quote Michael Eric Dyson from his book, Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster, where Dyson states, "Until many white and well-off folk feel the full force of black pain and open their eyes to see racial and class suffering, that divide will only widen, and the black poor will continue to be left behind long after Katrina recovery efforts are over." That's Michael Eric Dyson from his book, Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster, for Uprising Subversive Thought. You've been listening to Uprising. Our producer is Gabrielle Sandroman, and our assistant producer is Kelly Barnes. Our engineers were Teddy Robinson and Tamika Zoghi. You can hear a podcast and listen to the audio stream or download an MP3 of our program at our website, www.uprisingradio.org. Just click on Weekly Programs. You can email us at mail@uprisingradio.org, or you can order a CD of today's show at pacificaradioarchives.org or call 1-800-735-0230. Sitting in for Sonali Kohatkar, I'm your host, Thane Mori Soundararajan. Tune in for next week for another edition of Uprising, and thanks for listening.